Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I have a really talented guitar player with us today. I'm with Lindsay Miller, and Lindsay's a woman, in case you're wondering. I mean, you'd hear that when she talked, but just anyway, because, the Lindsay thing. She spent the last 17 years enjoying a diverse career as a freelance guitarist, a touring and session musician. She's a native of Prairie Village, Kansas, and she is literally the first human being I've ever met from Kansas. So we're having a discovery day today here at Everyone Loves Guitar. And she began playing guitar at age 10, and her early music inspiration revolved around bands such as the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, and Led Zeppelin, and they eventually evolved to include jazz artists such as Pat Metheny and Miles Davis. Lindsay's affinity for jazz guitar earned her a scholarship to attend the world-famous jazz program at the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, where she got a bachelor's degree in jazz performance. I'm always on my toes when I have you jazz people on because you're like super above the IQ curve sharp. So,
pressure's on now. Stop saying it's stupid.
After spending several more years gigging in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Lindsay made the leap to Nashville, where she maintains a unique role in the music community. Because of her ability to play almost any genre of music and to read standard music notation as well as Nashville numbers, Lindsay's often called on to play sessions and gigs that require multiple musical skill sets. You might see her on anything from a Hal Leonard publishing project to an artist record or a tour or a musical at Tennessee Performing Arts Center. And let me just say this before I continue reading the bio. You need to check her out online, Lindsay Miller, Lindsey, and she is an amazingly talented guitar player. She's a hell of a shredder, and she's like very reserved about her talent, but she's a force of nature, I can tell you that much. It's true. Don't thank me, thank you. Lindsay's worked and performed with the following artists and musicians: Lauren Daigle at the 2016 Christmas tour opening for King and Country, Tara Thompson, Desmond Child, who wrote songs for Aerosmith, and Bon Jovi, he wrote Living on a Prayer, Bad Medicine, and Dude Looks Like a Lady. Keith Carlock, who's the drummer for Steely Dan, Toto, and John Mayer. Danny Gottlieb, jazz drummer for Pat Metheny, Gil Evans Orchestra, and he's got 9 Grammy nominations. Grammy winner Jeff Coffin, who's the saxophonist for Dave Matthews and Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. Other credits include 6 episodes of ABC and CMT TV show Nashville, 5 performances with the Kansas City Symphony, including Lord of the Rings Symphony, Fort Worth Symphony, featuring contemporary Christian singer Steve Green, Dallas Theater Center, Tennessee Performing Arts Center, Hal Leonard Music Express, Oregon Catholic Press, Lifeway Publishing, and World Music. And as I said earlier, if you want to see some great playing, check her out on YouTube. This young lady can really shred with the best of them. And she's always smiling, which is like such a really nice character trait. So thank you, Lindsay, for coming on the show. I feel exhausted already. I feel like the interview's done. I have no more energy after I've read your bio. That's pretty impressive, man. You're doing a lot of good stuff.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. So yeah. What are you working on now that you're most excited about?
The year's kind of winding down, but something that was released this year that I've been really excited about is the album I played on, that Jeff Coffin's album called Next Time Yellow, that included Keith Carlock on drums, a really great piano player named Chris Walters, bass player Matt Wigton, who plays with Jody Messina and does a lot of other things around town. And then we had some featured guests like Tim Reynolds, who's the guitar player for Dave Matthews, sure, was on it too. And what was kind of cool is that we all did the basic core of the tracks at Jeff's studio, which is in his house. And then I wasn't really sure what direction the album was going to go in. And then I got it back and suddenly it was like, oh, and now Tim Reynolds is on this and everything. And it ended up being pretty surprising how it turned out from where it began. So just a really cool jazz project. And that's the first time I've ever played with Keith Carlock and those guys. And slightly intimidating, but also pretty exciting as well. So check it out. Yep.
It's called Next Time Yellow by Jeff Coffin.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, so you didn't get to play with Tim then? He did tracks after you?
He did. We're on the same track, but what happened was we were, because it's jazz and jazz is always improvised and free, we kind of played the core of the song, and then we just sort of did a jam out at the end of the song that actually ended up lasting like 3 or 4 minutes.
That's
and
a lot.
I was like, oh, I don't know what Jeff's going to end up doing with that part, because it kind of, you would think you would fade it out after 30 seconds, you know? And then we got the album back, and he asked Tim to record a second guitar solo over that vamp at the end of the tune. So suddenly I got the track back, and it's like, oh, it's me. Oh, and then, oh, it's Tim Hill. Which is so cool, but at the same time, I was like, wow, I didn't know you did that. That's awesome. So it really wasn't a surprise. So you can hear both of us on the same track on that. So,
Keith Carlock, is he currently with Toto?
He has, he's played with them in the past, done tours. And Steely Dan, he's done tours with them. And then more recently, he played with John Mayer on one of his tours a couple of years ago. But he's played with all those guys. He's really a force of nature, like really incredible with a great resume of people he's played with. Also a North Texas alumni as well. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think all those guys in Toto and, well, I mean, Steely Dan and Toto are just really good musicians. I just interviewed the bass player from Toto. That's why I was curious.
Really?
Yeah, do you know him? Shem Von Schreck?
I don't, but I mean, those were all incredible. Well, I guess they still exist, but they're all incredible bands.
Yeah,
definitely. Really good guy. Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you get that gig? Like, how did that materialize?
The Jeff Coffin thing?
Yeah.
Okay, man, it's crazy. So Jeff played saxophone with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, which Bela Fleck is a really well-known banjo bluegrass player that kind of started this like faux jam band type thing in the late 90s, early 2000s. Jeff played with him for about 14 years, and that was about the time that I was in high school. So just being kind of into jazz and sort of dabbling in jam band stuff, but not really. Everyone I knew was familiar with Bela Fleck, which his band also had Victor Wooten, the bass player, in it, who's incredible as well. And
so he lives in Nashville, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And he has a bunch of brothers that live there too. His brother played drums in that band as well.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I grew up listening to them, so it's kind of a soundtrack to my high school experience, maybe.
That's cool.
It is, and I knew Jeff lived here, and I knew Victor Wooten lived here, and when I first moved here, I went to, like, some bar somewhere where Jeff was playing with somebody, and I was like, oh, man, that's Jeff, and I was like,
come on, were you stalking him?
No.
I went to some bar somewhere, I randomly, it was really weird, I saw Jeff in there, I couldn't believe it.
Standing outside his house looking in his window, and she's there. None of that happened, but I was at a bar watching him play, and he was also playing with a trombone player in town. His name is Roy Agee, and Roy played with Prince for a while too, and I was like, well, this is awesome. I'm new in town, and in my mind I was like, I'm never gonna play with these people, but this is cool to watch from a distance. And then maybe a couple months later, the phone rang, and it was like, hey, this is Jeff Coffin. And I was like,
no, he was checking. He was hanging. He was looking at, he was creeping you out in the bar.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, well, this is scary.
So this is right after you move in? Right after you moved here, this happened?
No, it was several months after. Okay. But still, like, it seemed to me out of the blue. I know the connection now, but like, I was like, oh my gosh. And he was like, hey, I have jam sessions at my house. Do you want to come over and play and stuff? And I was like, well, yeah, inside I'm terrified, but I'm like, yeah, I'll come play. And so he just like will randomly just have people over at his house to play all the time. And that's kind of how I got to know him. We've become friends and played since then in various situations. And so one day he, maybe a year later, a couple of years later, he texted me. He's like, hey, are you available to record on this date? And I was like, well, sure, yeah. And then he was like, okay, these are the other people on it. And then that's when he was like, Keith Carlock, Chris Walters, and my friend Matt. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. Yeah. But still, it was great. And yeah, the session went great, and the product turned out great. So I'm really thankful. Jeff is actually probably one of the most generous people here in town as far as facilitating a music community and helping people get work. And just like his jam sessions, he invites so many different people over that you could end up show up and you never know who's going to be there. And you can just connect with so many people that way. So he's a great asset to the Nashville community, honestly. So
did you ask him, hey, how did you get my number? I mean, that would be.
Oh yeah. Well, that actually goes back even, there is a trumpet player that lived here for a couple of years, and he went to North Texas where I went to college. And I randomly just ran into him somewhere, and I just went up and talked to him for a second. And he invited me to a completely different band that he was putting together. And it was through him that I basically met almost everyone that I personally know in town, including Jeff, because someone gave my number to Jeff and was like, she's a great player. You should call her up if you need a guitar player. And that's how it happened. I found out later. But
that's really cool.
It is, but at the time it seemed pretty out of the blue, but
yeah,
really cool that it happened. So
that's, you know, I'd be thinking, because I grew up in New York, I'm always like trying to look at like what's the angle. I'd be like thinking, like if I was your friend or your dad, I'd be like, man, what a clever way to meet girls. Hey, I'm having a jam session over my house.
That was a thing where for a while, person new in town, there's a lot of shadier guys in town that will say, hey, I've got a recording session. Can you come play on my track? But really, they're just hitting on you, basically. So
really? That's so cheesy.
You develop a sixth sense for when you can tell that that's bogus. And in fact, that happened once when I was playing a gig downtown, and all I was doing was loading stuff up into my car, and these guys at this kind of ghetto fabulous club were standing like across the street. One of them comes up to me and is like, hey, I need a female to play on my track. And I'm like, I was like, no, you don't. He's like, sorry, I'm not doing that. And he's like, can I get your number? And I was like, no. And then he's like, can I get your number from that guy? And he pointed at my friend that was standing next to me, and I'm like, no.
Holy so that is so cheesy.
Some random person on the street and be like, hey, I need you for a session.
It's at my house on Saturday night.
The only one at it, and exactly. And I was just
that's a thing for like creepy dudes up there. Then pathetic.
Girls, that's the MO sometimes.
Oh my god. Well, that's really good that it's, you know, I always, one of the things that amazes me when everybody I talk to, almost everybody has a story like that where, you know, you'd never imagine the dots connecting like that. So you happen to go to school in North Texas. You happen to bump into this guy who also went to school at North Texas, and he's really networked in town, and you randomly bump into him somewhere, like totally, you know, if you had slept in 5 minutes later that morning, that event never happens.
Oh, it was totally like that, because I saw someone mentioned that he went to North Texas. I'm like, well, I should probably go say hi. But I'm debating whether I really want to in my mind. I'm like, all right, I'll just go do it. And I did. And if I hadn't gone and talked to him that day, I would probably not know anybody in this town. I don't know. Or any of the people I know personally, it would have been a completely different story. It's so crazy how that stuff works.
Yeah. I mean, do you, when you seem pretty confident when you get invited, and just, so what's really interesting is, you know, I talk to people at all different levels. I talk to young guitarists, mid-career, mm-hmm. you know, firmly established, and everything in between. And everybody, I think, has the same, I don't remember who it was, but someone told me that, you know, the funny thing about the 10 best guitarists sitting in a room is they're all worried about what the other 9 guitarists are going to do.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. It's like you sit around and worry all day about, like, sometimes if I get on a recording session where I know there's going to be, like, really talented people on it, and I get a little scared, and then I realize, oh, wait, these guys are probably just as worried about their own personal stuff as I am, what they think, you know? So it's, like, it's just funny how your mind works that way, definitely.
And it's like that in every industry. It's not just music. I mean, it's in every business. I think that's just human nature. But you seem really confident when because your response to how you handle that was like, wow, that's intimidating, but yeah, I'm going to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's just about creating opportunities for yourself. I mean, deep down inside, yeah, sometimes I am completely terrified of the people I'm working with and everything, but it's kind of like you just have to like compartmentalize that so that you can just get in the door, you know, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes tons of sense. So how do you like, so there's a lot of musicians and just people in different, I think a lot of musicians listening to this, how would you, or what would you say to somebody who completely freaks out in that situation? Like, what do you do to, you said, okay, I compartmentalize it, but what, I mean, do you like talk to yourself or, cause I actually talk to myself in situations, yeah, like out loud.
Yeah. I don't, oh, you actually talk out loud?
Well, yeah, sometimes because like, okay. So if I'm in a, so if, like if my head goes places that it's not productive to go, yeah, I will talk to myself out loud because somehow when I do it, it's almost like my subconscious mind hears it as a third party giving me advice. It's very weird. And yeah. And so I'll just say, Craig, listen, what are you worried about? This is, you know, you're imagining all these things are going to happen. You know, you're this, you're that, you know, don't worry, relax. Or even if it's with my kids, like if I'm worried about something with my kids, which really in all honesty, doesn't happen much anymore. Cause as I've gotten older, I've sort of, managed, I'm much less involved in other people's shit in general, like emotionally. Like I just don't take it on, but it's more like when I'm feeling insecure about something.
No, I'm with you. Sometimes it helps if you have a friend or a significant other you can talk to. Sometimes it helps to tell them because sometimes they can just be the objective voice of reason. That's like they'll be like, oh, but think about this and what's really going on, and somehow it kind of breaks through the emotion of I'm so terrified and all these irrational thoughts are going through my mind. But then having a voice come in that's kind of like, look, blah, 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 it's going to be fine. And then you're like, okay, you're right. It's going to be fine. These people aren't worried about what you're going to do and everything, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes I find that even having some nervousness actually kind of gives you an edge in your playing. I don't know why, but for some reason that almost kind of helps me focus in a way that I couldn't focus before. I don't know, that's another way to imagine it. I'm trying to think of
I think that depends on I'm like that as well because I happen to be the kind of person for better or worse I do well under pressure, so if yeah. I you know when the pressure's on I'm like I take it as a like a challenge and I don't like to lose. It's very bizarre. Mm-hmm. All these nutty shit going on up in my head, you know, which happens with a lot of people, I think. I hope.
I hope
I'm not the only one who's nuts.
No, I think you're totally right. And then sometimes you just like, you're in a situation where it's like, look, you're going to have to buckle down and just plow through it because you're like, you have a responsibility to fulfill. And if you don't come through on it, it may cause such, you know, different things that happen. I don't know. In a musical context, it could happen that way, you know?
Right.
You just have to realize that the responsibility of what you're doing is outweighs your stage fright, basically.
Right. Yeah. So, just try to have a good time with it instead of having a stressful time, if that's possible.
Yeah, that's true too. But I was thinking of maybe sometimes if I played like with the Kansas City Symphony or whatever, or like any of those types of roles where it's like you're coming into a situation where you're in it now and you've got to show up and fulfill a responsibility or you're going to cause a lot of problems, basically.
Yeah.
that type of a situation. That's another way where it's just like the responsibility outweighs the stage fright, basically.
Are you responsibility driven?
Yeah, actually, I definitely am. I feel if I have more tasks to complete, I'm more productive. If I have a free day and I don't have anything going on, I kind of just sit there like, what am I going to do with myself right now? And kind of like freak out, I guess.
Yeah. So, no, I am too. It's a blessing and a curse, to be honest with you.
True, and I just have to be really proactive about finding being self-motivated to complete tasks on my own, basically. So
yeah, it was funny. Like my son, I have three kids, and my older son, all my kids were here at Thanksgiving, and my older one is 27 and a half, and he said something about Ann said, "Hey, Nick, did you bring your laundry over?" And he goes, "No, Mom, I did my wash already." And I'm like, "Man, I'm going to go buy a lottery ticket." Because, you know, he never does his wash. He brings it home and, you know, he pretends to do it here, but, you know, his mom does it. And he goes, "No, I'm going to buy a lottery ticket." I said, "Why?" He goes, "Because you're actually not working." And I was like, and it was like I made a conscious decision not to work today. And I felt so bad when he said that. I was like, "Man, I've got to do this more often." You know, because I'm performance driven, responsibility driven. Like if I'm, you know, I tie a lot of my self-worth to productivity, which is like absolutely stupid. Mm-hmm. But that's
what I'm the same way. I totally agree with you that a lot of my mental state is affected by how busy I am, basically. So
right, which is terrible because you never. It's like you're not. If you're like that, you're programmed to actually feel bad about yourself if you're not busy, which is like you can never enjoy yourself.
Well, and then it's horrible from a musician's perspective because you go through the seasons when it's like, I'm so busy, I can't even manage what I'm doing this month to next month. It's like, oh, I'm not as busy. Oh, I'm horrible. I should quit. Well, you know, things like that. Yeah. So it's a tough thing to kind of correlate with each other, basically. So
yeah, it is. Interesting. Hey, yeah. Let's talk about something you just mentioned. You talked about with the Kansas City Symphony, and how did you get like all this symphony work? And what are you doing when you're playing with these symphonies?
Oh yeah. Well, that goes all the way back to when I was growing up there and everything. So when I first started playing the guitar and I was taking guitar lessons, it just happens that when you come into guitar lessons, you're open to anything. You don't know what you're gonna learn, you know. It just happens that instructor I had taught me how to read music, and it wasn't like I was like, I really want to learn music to read or anything. It's just like, I'm open to this, I'll learn how to read. And it turned out being a great thing because she was also a female player, and which doesn't really matter in the story, but anyway, she played
I won't say anything.
Yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. And so she played with the symphony, and it just happens in Kansas City there were only like three guitar players that could read music. So if two of them were sick, I was the third one.
Wow.
At a certain point to get called because there was no one else to call, you know. So if they needed someone, she wasn't available and the other guitar player wasn't available, or she wasn't available and there were actually two guitar books on the show. And it was like I was the only other person that could do it. So that's kind of how I got into it. So
wow, that's really cool. And so how have you gotten gigs with like the Fort Worth Symphony? Is that from when you were in school?
Yeah, kind of. That was kind of the connection there. Not like what was in Kansas City. It was just more of a school connection that way. And then in these symphony things, you know, I mean, when you think of symphony, you think of like classical music mostly, but there's Pops concerts in like where they add some jazzy stuff, so there might be guitar on that type of thing. And nowadays symphonies are kind of doing more stuff to reach out to demographics that wouldn't be interested in them. So they're doing more movie scores where they play the movie behind you while they play the soundtrack to the movie. So,
oh wow.
The Lord of the Rings Symphony, that was the soundtrack for the movie. In that case, I think they played scenes for the movie. I'm trying to remember, but I don't think they actually played. We didn't actually have to play to the movie. I think they just kind of showed scenes behind us. But that was one situation where you're playing music from the movie Lord of the Rings.
And that's really cool, though. It's a lot more enjoyable. Like if you're younger and not into into classical.
Well, absolutely. I mean, classical, I mean, it's the same as jazz. It's really, if you have no background in it, it just sounds like a
noise.
Basically like noise. So without some frame of reference, it's just really tough to just be thrown in the deep end and be like, I enjoy this, you know? So, So it's really cool that symphonies now do, you know, do more outreach stuff like that, where they're like, hey, well, just come check this out, and you'll have a context where you can understand kind of what's going on and everything. So
that's really cool.
So, yeah, it's a great thing that they're doing. So yeah.
So what was it? What was your, I said you're my first Kansas person. So tell me, what was your childhood like growing up in Prairie? You know, this is so funny. Like, and this is horrible. People who grew up in New York, like me, were very ethnocentric. It's like, it's horrible. I mean, I haven't even lived there in years.
Oh, I'm still, sure.
It's like, you know, there's this famous cartoon cover of the New Yorker magazine, and it shows like New York City, and then like there's like a little speck and it's California, and a little speck and it's Texas, and it's horrible. We don't even know that there's something in the middle.
I've heard that many times.
It's terrible. It's and I've lived in Florida now since 1989, so I'm, you know, I'm past that, but when I hear Prairie Village, I just can't help but think of like
covered wagons.
I'm from the Bronx. Yeah, yeah, right. So I'm thinking, you know, it seems, and I'm not making fun of it. My vision is it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
And it's like Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, you know, like fields, like beautiful cornfields or whatever. And I don't know any. It's probably ignorant. It's probably nothing like that. Maybe it's just like the Bronx for all I know. But what was your childhood like growing up in Prairie Village?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, for context, Prairie yes. Village is a suburb of Kansas City, so it's basically Kansas
okay.
City.
Okay, so it's just a rural, like not, any other rural suburb, any other suburb.
It's not rural either. It's kind of just.
Bedroom
similar.
Community?
Yeah. That's probably the best thing. And I realize you're not even from Nashville, so I was trying to say it'd be more like, I don't know, like Franklin, Brentwood, okay. Maybe.
Yeah, I stayed at Brentwood. No, not like Brentwood. It's too busy. It's probably like, you know what? I went to this place. Do you know who John Prestia is?
No.
He's Tim McGraw's guitar tech, and he's really awesome guy. If you ever have a chance to meet him, he's one of the nicest human beings you meet. And he lives in a place called the Hermitage. You know where that is?
In Hermitage, North Nashville.
Yeah. Man, that is gorgeous there. That is probably closer to what it's kind of like. It's suburbs, but it's not, you know, there's not a Starbucks on every corner. You know, there's a town. I don't know. That was beautiful. I really like that.
Yeah, kind of like Leave It to Beaver-ish, maybe. Sort of.
Like that Leave It to Beaver plus, you know.
Wonder Years-ish, maybe. Maybe that's
Yeah. Wonder Years-ish, yeah. Anyways, it was really cool.
That was Prairie Village. And I mean, Kansas City actually has a fairly good music community there. It had, especially for when I was getting into jazz, it was good for that, because a lot of guys that grew up there and moved away to New York, as they got older and got tired of being, you know, in a big city, would eventually move back to Kansas City and still play around town. So there were some good influences in the town for that genre. I'm not sure as much for, you know, rock and stuff like that, but definitely for jazz. So there was an urban element to the town. Suburban, you know, I'm trying to think of where I'm going with this, but yeah, for music, especially for jazz, it was good. So,
and yeah. What was your childhood like?
My childhood? Well, my parents, well, my family isn't a musical family. So I got into playing. I know some of the other guys that have been on your show are maybe like third generation, like
some, but most are. Parents. Yes, like half of come from some musical.
Yeah. So, and some don't, but I didn't come from a musical family. I kind of got into music because I had a really good public school music teacher, actually. And he kind of was really good more on the music appreciation side, for just getting people really passionate about it and interested in it. And then as far as getting a guitar, it's just kind of weird. Like, I just had a friend in school. She, for some reason, she was listening to the Beatles when she was like 9 or 10 years old. So I kind of got into it. And then we got in this little competitive thing where she was like, I'm going to get a guitar for Christmas. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get a guitar for Christmas. Yeah, and she never asked, I guess. And I asked my parents for a guitar, and they were like, okay. So they got me one and signed me up for lessons. And it was just kind of like, the rest was history, I guess.
And that was at age 10?
It was 10. So yeah, I started playing at 10 years old.
When did you get passionate about it?
I could say even back then I was passionate about it, but I think the time, like I always say, the Beatles got me playing guitar, but Led Zeppelin is the band that made me want to play it for the rest of my life, basically. So I saw, for some reason, I had a videotape, a VHS of The Song Remains the Same.
Oh, great movie.
Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah. And when I was 12 or 13, I remember watching it, and I was kind of like bored with it because it's pretty long.
It is long. And it has spots of like, where like when they're with Robert Plant's family, and it's a little, not dull, but flat.
Yeah, and I, for some reason I thought that there might be a plot to this, like Purple Rain or something. But and as I watched, I was like, "What is going on?" So I was a little bored. But when I made it to the end of the video where they were playing Heartbreaker into A Whole Lot of Love, and I was just like, "What is this? This is the most incredible stuff I've ever heard in my life." You know, and from there I was just like, "I want to play the guitar for the rest of my life, basically." So
very cool. The plot of that movie, by the way, is to you go to the theater and smoke a lot of weed. That after many years of study, that is my conclusion.
That is the plot, or the people making the movie were smoking a lot of weed and doing a lot of drugs, and they were like, you know what would be cool is if we made a movie that made no sense that was somehow around this one concert.
That's what I did.
And from there, I would kind of go back and rewatch the video. And in middle school, like 7th and 8th grade, I watched it every single day. And I'm sure my parents just absolutely hated me for it. Just because, not hated me, but we're just sick of it.
We're concerned.
Every single day. So and they're like, can you listen to something else today? You know, so.
Most of the kids your age are watching ABC After School Special, and you've got Led Zeppelin on.
I know, and my mom would be like, those lyrics, oh my gosh, and, you know, stuff like that. So,
well, that's really cool, I think. But, okay, so do you have, like, brothers and sisters, or are you an only child?
I don't. I'm an only child.
So. Interesting. I have a lot of musicians that I talk to that are only children. Is that right? Only children? Yeah. That's really interesting. I wonder if there's a study on that, like.
Maybe, because you don't have anyone else to interact with, so you just play an instrument, I guess.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Interesting. What kind of work did your mom and dad do?
Well, my dad worked they're both retired now. He worked in finance, and my mom just did a lot of, like, worked in hospitals and, like, their records, keeping medical records and things like that. So.
Sure.
Nothing too fascinating, I guess.
So let me ask you this. You're growing up and Jimmy Page is making you play guitar, and then you go to college to study jazz. How did that what happened? What Kool-Aid did you sip to do that?
That's a good question. Well, my dad did have a record collection where he's actually is a jazz fan, and he had a record collection that had a lot of really cool jazz records in that. So I was checking that out, but also my high school had a really great music program, and they had a jazz program there. Not all high schools get to have that, but my high school did. And the band director that ran the high school jazz band made some announcement once that he's like, the best musicians in the school are in the jazz program. And I was like, well, I want to be the best musician in the school. So I'm going to try out for this, even though I knew nothing about jazz at the time. So
I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And I just started kind of discovering more jazz records and just growing with it. It's not something where you listen to it the first time and it's like, this is amazing. I don't know. Maybe for some people it is that way, but it wasn't like listening to Led Zeppelin. It took a long time to kind of develop a taste for it, definitely. So,
you know, I've listened to, what's that famous Miles Davis album? Blue or something?
Kind of Blue.
I've listened to that or tried to listen to that a half a dozen times or more. And I don't think I ever get past the first song even. And it's almost like, you know, trying chewing tobacco or something. It always felt like I have to go through, you know, I'll get a taste for it. And I never like, why the hell this is music? Why would I want to wait to get a taste for it? And I've really tried hard.
Oh, I agree. Actually, the funny story with that is I had a Guitar Player magazine back when I was in high school that for some reason, this issue would list decade after decade of the best guitar albums of that particular decade. And I don't know why, but they listed Miles Davis' album called Bitches Brew as the best guitar album because John McLaughlin played on it. And I was like, well, if this is the best album of that decade, I'm going to go check this out. And I hated it. I thought it was the worst stuff. I was just like, I don't get this. This isn't, it doesn't even sound like Kind of Blue. It's more avant-garde. And I was just like, this is terrible. I'm never going to listen to this again. And so I put that away for a long time. And then I kind of got it back out maybe my senior year of high school, junior, senior year. And suddenly I was like, I get it. Like, this is
something melodies. About it made sense to you.
Yeah. Something about the couple of years in between kind of helped me. And I was like, I get it. And that's at the moment I was like, I love this album. And I listened to it every single day for like my senior year of high school, basically. So
that's interesting. I've really tried, you know.
Oh, I get it. Anyone that says they hate jazz, I'm not offended. I totally understand.
You know, it's not that I hate it. I don't get it. I have a hard, I just never got it. It didn't.
It's true. I mean, because you have to kind of understand when the actual composition of the tune is ending and when kind of the improvised solos are beginning. And if you can kind of hear the difference between those two, that gives you your basic structure for what's kind of going on. But if you have no framework for that, it basically just sounds like a lot of noise.
It's just, the thing is, like, I listen to music to feel something. Mm-hmm. You know, music is a way for me to feel good or decompress or get motivated, or I have to feel something. And that's what I've always missed in most jazz. I just never, there was never any emotional connection for me.
That's interesting. I think that's more just finding the right albums to start with where you can find that emotional connection. Cause there's definitely albums that you won't connect to emotionally cause they're just too cerebral or for whatever reason.
What are you trying to say?
Oh, I'm not saying anything. I was just saying
they're too cerebral.
I don't know. Same could go for like rock or country or rap. You know, I mean, there's probably people that are like, I hate country music, but they haven't found the right record that speaks to them. I don't know.
Could be. So, I have listened to like Dave Brubeck. I like his stuff. You know, that's kind of like, I don't know. For some reason, I can handle that. But
yeah. And another thing in jazz that might give people some more framework is a lot of artists nowadays are re-recording famous pop and rock tunes. Like a lot of them now play Radiohead tunes and things like that. So
that's quite funny.
And it's pretty cool to listen to it. So if you kind of start there, at least you're like, I recognize the Radiohead tune, and it kind of can give you a place to start with at least.
Something the dime dropped and something happened that you just got turned on to McLaughlin and boom, that was it.
Yeah, right.
Why did you go to college as opposed to just going out in the music world? Is there like what I'm trying to figure out what was going through your mind when, you know, college, and why'd you pick Denton to go instead of somewhere else?
Sure. I mean, like I said, I didn't come from a musical family or a ton of, you know, just musical background. So for me, it's always been kind of just like, I have to kind of figure out a career path on my own, you know, whereas some people might get some career counseling about, you can go here and start here. I was like, well, I kind of have to feel this out. So college is a good networking thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, there's definitely were holes in my musical education that it could definitely fill. So North Texas is actually a really famous jazz program. They're the only college program that's ever been nominated for Grammy Awards, actually. So, oh, wow.
And you knew that going into it?
Oh, yeah. And a lot of, they have an extensive list of alumni that I don't know if listeners would recognize them all, but like Keith Carlock went there. Oh, Rich Redman, the drummer for Jason Aldean, he went there.
Oh, okay.
Jim Riley, the drummer for Rascal Flatts, went there. I've heard a rumor Paul Shaffer went there, but I can't verify.
Really? From Letterman's band?
I don't want to say something completely wrong, but I heard something along those lines. Don Henley went there, but didn't major in music. So
that's funny.
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
He's from Texas, I think, isn't he?
He is. Yeah. And there's others. I just can't think of it off the top of my head. So
how far was that from, you know, Prairie Village where you grew up?
Yeah, it's 8 hours away.
Okay. So close, far enough that you know, could be away from home, but close enough that you can get back pretty quick if you needed to.
Yeah, not too bad. It wouldn't have been like, I also thought about, you know, University of Miami or Berkeley, and those would have been a lot farther away, definitely.
Sure.
Or a New York school or something like
that. Yeah, University of Miami, coming from Kansas, because I used to live, yeah, we live in Tampa now, but we used to live on the East Coast. It's a little rough there.
Yeah, definitely.
And so then what prompted you to move to Nashville?
I kind of got burned out with the jazz thing. I mean, it's so consuming when you're in school. And by the time I got out of school, I was just like, almost like, I'd rather try get back into my roots playing, you know, rock or in country and things like that. So I kind of stayed in the area just because I didn't have, I was already kind of established with gigs and stuff, so I didn't want to move right away. But eventually I was kind of like, I'm kind of at an age where I have an opportunity to still take a risk and try something new if I want to. And Nashville felt about right. It still wasn't too far away from home and wasn't ridiculously expensive to live there. And I have some family that lives here too. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah. So I thought, you know, I'd give it a try and just kind of see what happens. So that's what I did. So,
and it's worked out.
It has, absolutely, yeah.
Question for you.
Sure.
You've been doing this a long time, and mm-hmm. if you're open to sharing, everybody in whatever they do makes mistakes in their career. Would you be open to maybe sharing one or two mistakes you've made during that time and the lessons you learned from that, from those mistakes?
Sure. You were asking questions about, you know, going to a college for music and everything. And I think the biggest mistake is that when you're in college, you get so consumed by just doing music in college that you forget that there's a whole other world around you of players and just, you almost forget to find yourself as a musician because you've spent so much time trying to please teachers and fit in with that situation. And I think my mistake was that I just got so consumed in making college my identity at that point that I should have gotten out more probably. Another guy, this Christian artist named Matt Maher, he majored in jazz at Arizona State University. He said the same thing. He's like, man, too many people in college just treat that like a god, and it's not what the real world is like, basically. So,
Get it. So just like in any other profession, when you go to school, they don't teach you real world shit. They teach you technical shit, but you get too caught up in it because you're so closely, because it's music and it's such a personal thing that you get into the performance, making them happy as opposed to venturing out and seeing what the rest of the world is like.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that's pretty spot on. I mean, it's just, you treat what the teachers do give you valuable information. That's definitely for certain, but it comes, you get to a certain point where you need to like find what you like as an individual and not necessarily just agree with whatever they're telling you, like just developing a certain amount of autonomy as a player, I would say. And especially coming from like that jazz college tradition, that kind of music degree is not always relevant to what's going on in the real world, basically. Like moving to Nashville, I mean, they never taught me about what goes on in a session, which they probably taught people at Berkeley, but definitely not at North Texas, or they never taught me about getting your gear together and your rig together, or just any of the tips and helpful things that you would come across in a touring or a session situation, definitely.
Sure, Sure.
So, yeah.
So if you can go back and give advice to your younger self, what would you have advised yourself to do?
Sure. I mean, I would definitely, everything I just said, I would definitely tell myself that. It's like, you don't, I mean, it's okay to take, you know, take in what you can from the college experience, but don't let that consume you so much that you lose your identity as a musician in it, you know. So that'd probably be the biggest thing I could tell myself. So
thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just taking some notes.
Sorry.
Let's talk gear for just a few minutes.
Sure.
And most of your videos, I see you playing usually a Tele, but if I think I'm looking over there, it looks like you got a Gibson in your rack.
Deller.
On the middle, in the second and the third one.
I have a Les Paul, definitely.
Do you have your Sunburst Jimmy Page Les Paul?
No, it's black, and it's a custom. It comes from their custom shop. I think it was built in 2011-ish. So, and then I have two other Gibsons. I have a 335 and I have a 135, which doesn't
what
get
is
out
that?
The case. It is, it's similar to a 175, which is like more of a hollow body with a really big body.
Yeah. The jazz thing.
Exactly. Except the 135 is semi hollow. So the body is a lot thinner.
Gotcha.
So more like a 335 if it had a cutaway. But doesn't totally sound like a 335.
Sure. What's your go-to guitar right now?
I would say it kind of revolves around. I have a Strat that is a 50th anniversary Strat. It only will be a go-to because I know I can walk into most any situation with it and it'll come through. Hmm. That if you don't know like what your backline's going to be, I know I can play rock.
What does that mean, your backline?
So if you were doing a tour, if you're on a tour or you're on a fly, if you're flying to a gig far away, it's obviously extremely difficult and pricey to bring an amp with you.
Hmm.
So a lot of times the promoter will provide an amp for you or a drum set. Same thing with bass players. They might provide an amp for the bass player as well. But the problem is you may sometimes specify the specific amp you want and you may show up and it's something, I don't know, not what you want, something right. Not good, you know? So,
that's called a backline.
Yeah, it's called a backline basically. Okay. And I know with that guitar that I can probably make that work with a really not good amp basically. So it's just been it's a safety thing for me. Also, and then the other guitar, I play my 335 quite a bit. Just cause I like it a lot.
Oh, I love that. I love that guitar.
I love 335 too. That one. And I guess also I have, a Nash Telecaster. That's also, it would be my favorite, except it doesn't, it really sounds the best for rock and country basically. Hmm. So I can't use it for everything, but when I do get to use it, I'm like, I wish I could play you all the time.
Do you find that happens like if you haven't picked up one of your guitars in a while, like that just feels like that anyway, man? Like it's like an old friend you haven't connected with in a while and it's like, wow, this is so cool. Yeah. Why don't we hang out more often?
Oh, absolutely. It's always that way with the Nash. Like anytime I get to play it, I'm just like, I love you guitar so much.
That's really cool.
And I have a Gretsch 6120 that's the same way. It's like, I wish I could play you all the time, but I can't. But I love you.
That's cute. Yeah. Is there any cool stories about how you acquired any of those guitars?
Yeah, well, not necessarily acquired, but that Nash. So Nash is like a boutique line of guitars. They make like things that look like Strats and guitars that look like Teles, only maybe set up differently. That's kind of cool.
The guy's name is Bill Nash, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And is he in Nashville?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I could be totally wrong about that, but I don't think so. Anyway, when I first got the guitar, the unique thing about that Tele is that it has a Bigsby tailpiece, and it had a tremolo bar on it.
Wait a minute. Had a Bigsby and a tremolo?
Yeah. In fact, I'll just grab it over to you. So, the Bigsby, and then you'll see there is no tremolo. There is no tremolo on it right now. But so what happened was it sounded amazing. It had so much character and a lot of resonance and stuff. But when I first got it, it never played in tune. It was always, the setup on it wasn't great. And part of it was the tremolo bar on it just was always making it go out of tune. So I took it to get set up to these two wacky brothers in Fort Worth, Texas that lived and worked out of like a trailer or something. But they were the guys that I recommended to go to. So, you know, I'm like driving out to the secluded, you know, little old me driving out to a secluded place with my guitar, like, can you fix my guitar? But, so I brought it to them and they were cool, a little wacky, but like, I was like, hey, I love this guitar, but you know, it has these tuning problems and it's like the tremolo, you barely touch it and it's out of tune. And they're like, oh, that sucks. We'll work on it for you. So I get the guitar back. I open up the case and they took the tremolo bar off the guitar.
And that was their remedy?
That was their solution, yeah. So they bolted down the little spring and just took the bar off. And I was like...
And you still have the Bigsby, though.
I still have a Bigsby, but no tremolo.
Where's your Bigsby arm? I can't even see...
The arm is gone.
Oh, they took that off? Or you just... Oh, okay. Yeah.
Arm off, so like it's not even on there anymore.
So you don't have a Bigsby. You went from having a Bigsby and a tremolo to having no Bigsby and no tremolo.
Well, I have the Bigsby tailpiece, but no tremolo.
Yeah, well, I mean, so does a tailpiece do anything without? I mean, like, is there an added value to that? Just a Bigsby tailpiece?
I've heard a rumor that it helps maybe with intonation having it, and I really think it probably adds a little more sustain that wouldn't be there.
That's what I hear from.
But the main purpose of it is so you can do, you know, tremolo.
Yeah, that's why I'm like.
Right. So like, so the arm is gone, and I'm like, thank you. Okay, but the arm is in the case, and I guess I could have it put back on, but
I
never did. And I really think that it lost a little bit of its character that day, but it still is an awesome guitar. But I was always like. People ask me, they're like, why do you have a Bigsby with no arm on there?
Thank you. I'm glad you said that because I thought I was asking. I wasn't sure I was asking the right question.
Different terminology, but no arm.
Yeah. So, it's like, that's the day the music died.
I'm like, funny you should ask because there's a funny story about that. So, yeah. So that's my story about that guitar.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
I know how much of a Zeppelin fan you are. Has Jimmy Page impacted your playing at all?
You know, that's the funny thing with records. You know, when you first start listening to record as a little kid, it's kind of like you just listen to it for, I don't know, the ambiance, or like it hits you in a way emotionally or that you can't really explain. And then every time I come back to those records over and over again, it's important to me for a different reason. So nowadays when I listen to it, I kind of respect Jimmy Page more as the studio guitar player and kind of as a producer that he was on those albums, you know, more so than anything specifically that he played. But nowadays I'm kind of like, listen to a mix and I'm like, man, that guitar overdub in Physical Graffiti on one of the tracks, I'm like, is so loud. It's louder than the vocals. And I'm like, I wonder why he chose that. And those are the types of things I kind of respect him more for these days than when I was first trying to learn his licks and was kind of like, just trying to figure stuff out, I guess. So,
well, that album in particular, I would say, was a much more heavily tracked album than their earlier stuff.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. That one, and they spent a lot more time on, but some of those albums, I think they spent like a month or 3 weeks maybe or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely kind of respect him more just for his production side and how he operated in the studio. Although his live playing is just as cool to me too. I also respect them though too, because like from a live perspective, it's kind of like, minus the vocals, for all purposes, they were like a trio that could fill up a huge arena. You know, they didn't even have background vocals, you know, barely. Maybe they had a couple of like sort of things on a couple tunes, but they were just, their sound was huge with basically three musical instruments. And yeah. I always thought that amazing. And then it made me realize how much of a burden was on Jimmy Page to execute a ton of parts. And it's almost like the whole burden was on him to like get that music, you know, to be the glue that held it together in some ways, you know.
So. But I think all three of those guys though were just, I mean, you look at Bonham, I mean, that is, I haven't, you know what, funny enough, do you know, I asked you once, you know who Government Mule is, right?
Yeah, totally.
So Matt Apps, I've seen them several times, like four or five times in concert, and he hits the drums really hard, not as hard as John Bonham, but he hits those drums really, really hard. And he's a totally different style player, of course, but... Mm-hmm. I see what he does, and I can only imagine what Bonham, you know, he would all, it was a pretty, I think all three of them were very expansive, had to be very expansive in their playing. Absolutely. And I think they all did a great job, and they were all very, very talented. Incredibly talented.
I think if any of those members had been different, it would have been a completely different band. It wouldn't have been this at all. And I totally agree with you on all fronts on that. Absolutely.
So. I'll tell you what's interesting. I'm a big Pink Floyd fan, and, and I love Gilmour, and you know he's my go-to guy. But he had just recently came out with a new DVD in Pompeii, where he played Pompeii, and it was kind of interesting because Pink Floyd did a DVD in Pompeii like in 1964 or something like that, in the late 60s or early to mid 60s even, and they just played in the stadium with nobody in there, and they just did a movie of it. Yeah, it was really cool, and then. Gilmour did a concert in there, and it was the first time there was a concert in Pompeii since like, you know, 5 AD or something like that, literally almost 2,000 years. And he had, you know, Rick Wright was the keyboard player. He passed away. And Nick Mason was the original drummer, and he's got his own drummer, a guy named Steve DeStanislaus. Anyway, really good drummer. But it was really interesting. These guys were playing their parts, but it didn't sound like them. You know, and these are really well-trained, great guys. And so I think it really showed something about, you know, it's a lot more to, you know, it's all about the individual, you know. And I agree with what you said. It was why I brought that up. If it wasn't those three doing it, it would have been a very different band.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's applicable in almost any music situation. Like, guys, one of the engineers / producer guys I work with in Nashville tells me, he's like, man, when I'm recording these, like he does a lot of like string sections and things like that. He's like, when I'm recording these people, he's like, you would be surprised how, if I just switch two seats around and put people in a different seat, how the vibe would just even change completely recording them.
Interesting.
Like he said, there's so many things that come into question, like personalities, who gets along with who, and everything. It can change everything, and he always has to consider who plays well together and everything we've just been talking about. Just change one person out, the whole sound can change.
That's really interesting. So if you think about that, that means like the chances of having great records come out aren't really that good.
I don't know. I mean, it could just be, it just makes you wonder about if one person was different. It's not that it wouldn't be any better or worse. It would just be completely different. And you always wonder what the possibilities are, you know? Combining different people together. So
that is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I'm going to ask you three more questions because I know we got to get going, and I really appreciate your time. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or would find a little odd.
I don't know. Okay, I've already told you this, so maybe you're the only one that knows this. But
I'm the only one. Shh, everybody, listen.
I was so obsessed with Led Zeppelin at one point that I own 125-ish bootlegs of Led Zeppelin.
There you go.
I've never been able to listen to all of them.
Oh, I know. It's impossible.
Yeah. But I own them. So there we go.
That is good. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
No, other than this past year, I've been really good about getting into running. So I'm trying to step that up. But yeah, no, nothing huge. Like I haven't run a marathon yet or anything.
That's cool. That's like, it's really important to do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And take care of yourself, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that would be my hobby. So
that's good.
Right now. Yeah.
And the last question is a tough question. What's the toughest decision you ever had to make, or the hardest thing you had to do?
The hardest thing I've ever had to do.
Or toughest decision you had to make.
Toughest decision. Man, now you're putting me on the spot. What did some other people say? You have to give me an idea here for a second.
Like a default answer is, and I don't believe this is the real answer. I believe it was a tough thing to do, but I don't believe it's the toughest thing to do. A lot of guys have said leaving a certain gig, you know, when they had a steady gig and leaving that for another musician's gig, you know, it was hard to do that and to, because they, you know, if they were getting taken care of financially and the person was a really good person to work with or work for, it's tough to go in there and say, hey, for no seeming reason on your end at all, I'm leaving for a better opportunity. And they said that was hard. And I'm sure, and I'm not taking that away, but, you know, a lot of these questions are, and I don't mean this in any sort of disparaging way. It's hard to be 100% truthful answering these.
That's true, yeah. I mean, especially...
Because a lot of it's really personal.
It is, yeah. I would say probably...
So what's your, like, second, like, you know... Not the real answer. What's the fake good answer to that question?
Good answer. The hardest decision, I guess. I mean, this is sort of similar, but back in Texas, right after I got out of college, I was playing in a rock band that we all kind of thought was like really special and everything. And at that point, it was really important to me. And I think, but the traveling aspects of it were extremely difficult and things like that, those types of situations. And it was the same thing as probably be like having to leave that gig just because I knew it was an extremely unhealthy type of situation. But at the same time, you always have that thing in the back of your mind. Well, are they going to go on and do great things? And I made a horrible decision, you know, things like that, you know, always eat away at you. It never turned out that way, but.
Yeah, but if it's an unhealthy situation, even if they go on and do great things, it's not usually going to be wind up being good. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. No, it totally is. But you always worry about what other people are going to think about you with that situation. Like a couple people will ask me, they're like, why would you leave that particular group? And I was like, because I was extremely unhappy. But other people on the outside are going to not get it, you know. So I guess that would be the type of answer. The go-to answer, maybe.
That's good.
I think it's people. There's a lot more factors involved in the music, the tour, especially the touring aspects, than what people realize. Like, you may be on a bus with the most famous artist in the world, but you may be extremely unhappy because you're on a bus with a bunch of people that are not your favorite people in the world, or something may have happened, or you never know. And those are all the types of things that maybe music fans wouldn't understand. They're like, you're on the greatest gig in the world. It seems like you could deal with it, but you're around these people, you're playing with these people like for 5 to 10% of the day, and you're living with them for the rest of the day. Right. So that's kind of like,
everybody says that it's very consistent, that you got to be a good hang that.
Oh, absolutely. And just one person can like change your vibe, you know? So that type of a thing. Pretty standard answer, but it's a true answer, definitely. So.
I believe you.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, listen, you are a pleasure to talk with, and you know, you're really sweet, and I appreciate your time. Yeah. Is there anything you want to promote, or any, you know, people could find you on YouTube? Look up Lindsey Miller. It's Lindsey Miller.
Sure. Yeah, you can do that. You can also see what I'm doing on Instagram. Like, that's LBMiller83 is my Instagram.
LBMiller83. Eight, the year you were born. God.
Yes.
Ding, ding. I got it. That's slow learner. Yeah. And check Lindsey out on Jeff Coffin's record, Next Time Yellow.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Any final words of wisdom?
No, I think I've said everything I can think of. So,
thank you very much for your time. It was really nice talking to you, and I appreciate everything.
Sure.
Hey, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And I want to thank Lindsay Miller for all her time. And she's a lot of fun, and I really appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Now, be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. That's what it's all about, man. Until next time, peace and love. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.